Please enjoy this previously recorded segment.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, our guest is the one, the only, Deborah Weiss Ford, Managing Principal of Jackson Lewis Law Firm in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Deb, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Dave. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Well, you know, I was talking to you off air, and I just said what I will say on air is, gosh, there's nothing going on. Nothing. Nothing for lawyers to do these days.
No, and as I said to you, it's a good time to be an employment lawyer, which means it's a bad time for an employer.
Yeah, there's no question about it. You know, and our topic today, obviously, is so in the news. It's so prevalent. Today, we're going to be talking about hashtag MeToo. Sexual harassment goes viral. It's so crazy. I've never seen anything quite like this. Have you?
No, it's just an explosion that really was unanticipated. It is far-reaching across so many different industries and really keeping employment lawyers on the management side hopping these days.
You know, I think what were social norms before have changed. The expectations have changed. And we're going to talk as we go through, and we're talking about, obviously, respectful workplace. I think one of the interesting parts is, and we can have this conversation, is how far is too far, right? So where are the lines? I mean, like anything else, the pendulum swings so far, and then it probably swings too far. And so where are the lines going? What are you seeing on the trends? What are the things that are happening out there?
So I think that's right. I mean, this is really not a new issue. Issues regarding sexual harassment have been going on for literally decades. I mean, you know, the first known issue was back in 1975 with the case with Cornell University, and that's when the phrase was first coined of sexual harassment. And that moved into 1986 with the famous case of Meritor Savings Bank recognizing workplace sexual harassment. That leads you to Anita Hill and leads you to a lot of other things. So it's the same old issue. What's different and what's new is that today's stories beget more stories, and the volume is amplified by social media. And so I think the social media aspect of it has caused this to just explode. And that's really what we're dealing with today on a very, very different level.
Well, it certainly has, if you want to say, taken down icons, right? I mean, that's
yes.
It doesn't really matter if it's in the news media, if it's in the corporate world, if it's in the entertainment world. It has been far-reaching, impactful at every possible level, and has really emboldened people to come forward.
That's true. Just for example, in December, I was doing a training, and I had prepared a PowerPoint on a Sunday night. And by the time I did the training on the following Tuesday, there were three more celebrities who became added to the group of people who were accused of sexual harassment issues. So, you know, you feel like every time you do a training, you're updating a PowerPoint because it seems as though each week there are more and more names to add to the list.
Yeah, and from a standpoint of it's interesting, it always seems like people knew. Have you noticed that in this? It's like people knew. But either they were too afraid or it was just kind of expected back then, and now it's just not expected.
I think that's right, and I think that's a very good point. As I said, this is nothing new. I just think that the complaints were buried or people were afraid of retaliation, and for whatever reason, that has changed. And perhaps it's changed because of the strength of social media. It was an actor who brought forth the whole hashtag MeToo status, and that made global awareness about sexual harassment issues, and that meant that it went viral, and I think people felt more comfortable and safer actually making the complaints. So I think that's really what's going on.
It's also changed what employers and supervisors need to think about and do. And yes, it's always been the case that employers should be taking this serious. But let's be honest, you know, if I think back 10, 15 years, and we've been doing this maybe a few years longer than that, but I don't think we should explain that on the air. Do you, Deb, really? I don't.
No,
I don't.
It's not.
We're just going to skip that whole thing, and I'm sure everybody will just allow us to do that. The reality is that I know I used to hear, and I'm sure you did, that was our best salesperson. But that's our owner. But that's our CEO. But that's the key player of our organization. And the reality is there were times that employers would go, how do we kind of sweep this away? How do we deal with it? How do we contain it more than deal with it?
I agree with that. And, you know, we talked about this when we talked about the jerk at work and one of our radio programs, a couple years ago. And it's really the same issue. It often is the person who is the producer, the person who is your superstar, but has bad behavior. And from an employer perspective, it's sometimes hard to stop that behavior because this is your biggest revenue producer. And so sometimes I think some of the complaints were buried or maybe not dealt with very well. And I think that was a component. I also think that there was a lack of understanding of the impact of sexual harassment on the victims, which is substantial and serious and really needs to be dealt with. And perhaps in years past, it was not taken as seriously as it should have been.
We're discussing hashtag MeToo, sexual harassment goes viral. Is that the fault of employers? Is that the fault of, you know, us professionals, even attorneys, allowing that to be that way? Or is it just that the social norms have changed?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, from my perspective, I think it's a cultural issue. I think that many things have been accepted for years, and at some point, for whatever the reason is, that time in history or someone leads a movement or something here goes viral, as did hashtag MeToo, and people think about it more carefully and look at it from a different lens, all of which I think is healthy and productive and good for employers to do on an ongoing basis. And so I think it's more of a cultural issue of not really thinking through the impact of these issues on victims, that it really is unacceptable and that there should be a zero tolerance policy. And that's led to a lot of changes in trainings and in investigations, all of which I think are good things, because the goal, of course, is to get to the point where we don't have to say Me Too. That's really what the point is here.
No, I think you're right. And you know, obviously we're going to get into some of the meat of that here today. But the other thing I would just ask, if you're seeing that it's not just women, we're seeing this across men-on-men conversations. We're seeing this on a sexual orientation conversation. It's not just sexual harassment in the truest sense. It has really expanded, hasn't it?
Yes, I do agree. The last study I saw said that about 6% of men complained about harassment, generally by women, sometimes by other men. But that is a statistic that has been increasing over the years. And that's consistent with my practice. I would say I probably have about maybe 5% of cases where men are complaining about women harassing them or other men harassing them. And that's true of, you know, in my opinion, the amount of complaints for harassment have gone up in all of the protected categories. So whether it's sexual harassment or race or religion or, you know, disability harassment, I'm finding an increase in almost all of those classes.
So let's do a couple of basic things, which I know most of the listeners know, but I think it's good just to remind people. What is harassment under the law?
So harassment is difficult to define, and that's part of the problem I think that we have here. So the Supreme Court has defined sexual harassment situations in various cases across the years. And so what it really means is this: it's offensive or inappropriate conduct. And that can be physical, it can be verbal, it can be visual, and it's based on a protected characteristic. So in other words, it's based on sex. And that's different than a case where you may have a bully who is a bully to everyone, to the men, to the women, you know, an equal opportunity bully. But here, what we're talking about with harassment is that it's based on the protected class, the gender. It has to be unwelcome. It's got to be severe or pervasive. And those are the general requirements, all of which sound ambiguous. So that means that it often is a gray area and very, very difficult to define.
You know, one of the things that you just said was severe or pervasive. And that, I think, has become maybe the different definition changer, because what was severe or pervasive before is not necessarily severe or pervasive today. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that. I think it's very difficult to define. For the most part, in cases that I handle, it's a continuing line of events, whether they be sexual jokes or demands for sexual favors or unwanted touching, massaging, rubbing someone, inappropriate cartoons, that type of thing, all plays into the definition of whether or not it is severe or pervasive. Now, it can be one thing. You know, one thing can be so severe. You know, you and I are in a stockroom and you're my boss and you grope me and accost me in unwanted ways, then that one instance alone could be severe or pervasive. But for the most part, really what we see are a continuing line of issues that are occurring in the workplace.
And we still have protected characteristics, right? I mean, when we're really talking about harassment, it can be everything from race, color. What are some of the other things that are really involved in this?
So it could be race, color, religion, marital status in some states, sexual orientation in all states in New England, not federal yet, sex, pregnancy, age, disability, whether it be physical or mental. So there are a host of federal and state laws that talk about protected characteristics. And as lawyers, one of the first things we do when we hear the word harassment is try to decide whether or not the harassment is based on the protected category, meaning that a claim could be filed on the federal level or the state, or whether it's a bullying or jerk at work situation, which means that it does not fall under a protected characteristic. It may be something different, but it's not going to be a discrimination or harassment case based on those protected characteristics.
You mentioned the jerk at work, which is, by the way, still one of the top shows here on the HR Power Hour. No question. I always keep chuckling to myself because that is still one of our top shows. And maybe you should come up with a jerk at work, too, by the way. I want to throw that out there as an idea for later this year. Just thought I'd throw that out there.
Sure.
Anyways, having said that, the bullying component has become a bigger issue on this. Now, while that's not necessarily considered harassment, I do think right now this has become a bigger, grayer area.
It has. Interestingly, there have been a slew of states which have tried to pass legislation for anti-bullying conditions. Massachusetts is a prime example, and all of those measures have failed. So there are, to my knowledge, no state laws that specifically outlaw jerks at work or bullying. But this line between, first of all, what is bullying, and also whether the bullying really goes into a hostile environment claim, if it's a protected characteristic, is gray and often hotly litigated in both federal and state courts. So you're absolutely correct about that.
So, you know, I'm not going to obviously go through an entire harassment program with you, but one of the things you mentioned in the beginning of our conversation was that it keeps on changing the amount of information that you're providing in these trainings. What are some of the key areas that you now look at and say, these are part of the training program that you need to have? These are the things you need to do to have a respectful workplace and to really be the company's commitment to make sure that happens.
Right. So in 2016, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, did a report. And in the report, the commission concluded that trainings often failed as a prevention tool because they were too focused on simply avoiding legal liability. So there was quite a lengthy report by the commission that really talked about what trainings used to do, and some still do it this way, which is to provide, here's the definition, or maybe do it online and not have live trainings. And the commission went to great lengths to say, look, you know, you really have to find an effective sexual harassment training program, and you really need to change what you've been doing for many employers, that the old way of doing it is really not effective. And so out of that, the commission came up with some recommendations for how to do a better training. And that's really what I think a lot of employers are working on now.
When you're talking about a better training, what are maybe one or two components that you say you don't see in training today that really an employer has to think about and add to their program?
Yeah, well, the first thing I would say is that I think a lot of employers still are doing online trainings, which I don't think are very effective, and certainly my opinion doesn't matter too much, but the commission doesn't think that they're effective, and that makes a difference if you're going to have some kind of a claim on the federal level. So doing these in person with a trainer who is used to doing these type of trainings, I think is really the first point I would make. I do find that to be critical. Second, I really think that it's important to get these trainings to be interactive. So trainers should use hypotheticals, maybe real examples, but changing the names, to talk about real-world examples in the workplace so that employees can understand that, look, this is really what's going on. Here's the problem. How would you solve it? And then working with the employees to discuss how you're best going to resolve that particular issue.
Deb, you have a great point. You're going to be talking more about that in the next segment. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLLB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly Flagg, General Manager of the Body Architect Fitness Center in Portland, Maine. I want to personally invite you to come meet us. If you've been considering joining a gym but haven't yet because you're a little nervous or just plain old don't like the gym, come see us. We have created a 30-day personal training experience just for you. Meet our trainers, try a few workouts, and use our facility for 30 days for just $79. Call 774-2196 or visit thebodyarchitect.com today.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLLB 100.5 FM. And presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford, Managing Principal, Employment Attorney with Jackson Lewis, a great HR Power Hour sponsor. And we're talking about hashtag MeToo. Sexual harassment goes viral. You know, Deb, we're really having so many discussions today that we've had in the past, but I think it really has had a renewed emphasis on what it means. And so in this second segment, I'd like to talk a little bit about, first of all, what type of trainings are important. And I know you have an emphasis on employee training and employer training for supervisors. And then I'd like to focus a little bit on the supervisor part in regards to reminding employers what's so important about that. We'll then get into investigations, which I know are really a critical piece of this, if that works for you.
Yes, sounds perfect.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the two types of trainings an employer really should be having and why it should be different and why it matters?
Sure. So I think that sometimes employers make the mistake of only doing trainings for supervisors. And look, it's important, critical, absolutely mandatory to do supervisory training. But I also think that it's important to do trainings for the employees. And again, not just my opinion, but the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission takes the very strong position that one of the failures in the system has been that employees are not trained. And this means that employees feel that they don't know how to report an incident of sexual harassment. They don't understand what their rights are. They don't understand about retaliation, all of which can be remedied or at least partially remedied by trainings. So the issue is that you really need to do two separate trainings because supervisors have certain responsibilities that I think you and I are going to talk about in a few minutes, but they've got certain responsibilities and affirmative obligations to tackle harassment issues in the workplace. On the other hand, employees need to understand what are their rights, what happens if I am a victim, how do I report it, what do I do if my friend and coworker is harassed, do I have to report something, should I report something, do I need to keep it confidential, how do I tell management. And so trainings go through the law, the definition of the law, what harassment is, what it isn't, talk about the reporting procedures, talk about the policy, and then I am just a firm believer in going through hypotheticals or real examples in the workplace to make sure that employees are confident that they understand what to do and how we define harassment.
You mentioned the word retaliation. This is a big deal because, as you know, it's one of the biggest problems that employers face. How does a company encourage employees to raise concerns but also protect themselves at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, you're right, it is a increasing area in law to have retaliation cases. It certainly is common in today's employment world to maybe have a case for sexual harassment and then also have a count in the complaint for retaliation. And sometimes we're successful in dismissing the underlying cause of action, the sexual harassment, but we're left with the retaliation piece because the employer allegedly retaliated, took some adverse action based on someone making a good faith report. So what the employer has to do is this. They need a policy that needs to be a clear zero tolerance policy for sexual harassment in the workplace and for retaliation. They need to also establish a reporting procedure if employees feel that they have been retaliated against. And then the issue of retaliation really requires the employer to be very careful when it makes adverse actions. So if I'm going to terminate someone or demote someone or not give a pay increase, and it is around the same time frame when that person complained of sexual harassment, then I need to be careful about retaliation. I need to make sure that an objective, reasonable person would look at it and think that the real reason for the adverse action is the performance or the attitude and not because of the reporting. So that's a whole separate issue with employers needing to make sure that they train managers to document properly, because that's the biggest problem we see by far.
You know, it's interesting you're talking about avoiding liability, right? So you're talking about, hey, how can employers do a better job of avoiding liability when you're dealing with sexual harassment or retaliation? One of the things you mentioned is paperwork. What are some of the other things that people really need to be thinking about as employers to limit their liability?
Well, the policy, for sure, they need to have a policy. I mean, I still sometimes will see some policies that are really deficient, don't have a proper reporting procedure, are not explaining in plain English what harassment is and what to do about it. That's one. Failing to train is another avenue. Oftentimes, you have managers who are just unaware of the laws and their responsibilities. I mean, we see this in the sexual harassment field. We see this in the disability field with ADA issues and FMLA issues all the time. Managers not knowing what to do. You know, how do you request a reasonable accommodation? When do you go to HR and work with HR to make sure that you are addressing the employee's problems? So to me, training, training, training. I am just a big believer in that. I just think that employers need to do a lot more. You just can't assume that your supervisors will know what to do. And, you know, this is the eyes and the ears of the employer, right? They're going to be the first line people. So if they don't know what to do, then it's impossible for, you know, the CEO or the COO to really solve the problem.
Well, I think it also, as you mentioned right there, is critical for the CEO, the COO, and all senior level to also take these trainings. And I do see sometimes that, you know, they're not always there. And I think that that's a big miss and a big important step in today's development and training, that they have to be part of the process and have to reinforce it.
I agree. And just, you know, just by way of example, so just the other day I was doing a training for a client, and we did two management trainings and two employee trainings, so four trainings all in all. And the CEO went to every single one. And, you know, when I said to him after the third one, this must be getting repetitive and boring, he said, no, I think it's important for me to listen and to make sure that people understand that we are taking this seriously and that I am all in, because it starts from the top. And that's right. I really applauded him from that. That's exactly right.
No, that's exactly the way to do it. All right, so let's talk about supervisor responsibilities when it comes to harassment and when it comes to making sure that they are covering the way they should do these issues. And setting the example. What are some of the things that you see that are critical for the supervisor's responsibility in this case?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think supervisors, first of all, need to be out there. They need to be visible. They need to be walking around. They need to be identifying problems, and they need to stop if they see behaviors that are inappropriate in the workplace. And that can be done in a couple ways. I mean, some supervisors are comfortable saying to people, stop telling the sexual jokes, stop making the comments, this is inappropriate, etc. But if a supervisor is not comfortable doing that, I think the supervisor needs to know himself or herself well. And that means that they need to still do something, which would be punting to HR, you know, immediately saying something to HR so that HR can deal with the issue. But what they can't do is put their head in the sand and just pretend it's not there, because it's always going to come back to bite you. So that's one thing. I mean, the second thing would be that I think sometimes, because of a lack of training, supervisors don't understand the responsibilities that they have to report. So it's not just a direct report, but if they indirectly hear through gossip or something that's anonymous, they still need to take some action, you know, reporting it to HR, starting the process for the investigation. And that's true, too, that even if the employee says that it's off the record or please keep this confidential, the supervisor still has an affirmative obligation to start the investigation process, which normally would be reporting it to HR. And that last one is the one that I see that gets supervisors in trouble the most, not knowing that they really can't keep the confidence that there is no such thing as an informal complaint or something off the record. It's sort of a TV fiction. And I think that's a training issue for supervisors.
One of the things that, you know, has always come up, and you mentioned it, is documentation. And sometimes supervisors get told these things on the rush, right? Or they hear something quickly, but they're in the process of doing something else, or going and doing something. I mean, they're in a hurry. Hey, I've never known a supervisor to go on board, right? You know, they've got things going on. And so they say, hey, knock it off. And then they, off they go, right? Off to
right.
And they don't necessarily think much more of it past that. And I'm trying to be real world, right? Real world is the supervisor comes around the corner, they hear something, they go, knock it off. They all go, okay, and then they move on. Is that enough today?
Not in today's world. It used to be okay for something that was reasonably innocuous to just say, knock it off and move forward. But in today's world, I would say that that is not an appropriate response anymore. I think supervisors need to find the time. And whether it's right then or later in the day, maybe they, you know, jot a note on their phone or however they, you know, keep themselves up to date on matters that are going on, they need to report that. One of the reasons is that what the supervisor may not know is that this person who is the so-called harasser or engaging in the bad behavior could be someone who has done this before. And the supervisor may not know that, but HR should know that. You know, there's a historical reference that HR should have and likely does have that the supervisor may not know. And so when we get into this issue of whether a pattern is being created, that is going to increase liability issues for the employer and could come back to bite them.
No, I think that's the part that has really changed, right? That is, you know, supervisors are busy, and that's the reality, and especially if you're on a manufacturing floor, you got something going on. It was always okay to stop it and move on, and I think that's the point I'm trying to emphasize, that it is different today, and the expectation of that supervisor now and the responsibility and the liability to that supervisor is dramatically increased.
I think that's right, and I think what was tolerated in years past is not being tolerated in this point in time.
No, there's no question about that. So one of the other parts, as we say, is that, okay, the supervisors have now done this, they've kind of written it down, they're off the hook once they give it to HR. I certainly recognize that they've now done their duty. Hey, I'm telling HR, and I'm all done now.
Yep. So I think that HR and the supervisor at that point need to work together to get a game plan or some type of a strategy to make sure that the problem is being addressed correctly. And to me, that's a lot of walking around, checking in. You know, I always say to clients that, look, you know, when things like this happen, you need to check in with the alleged victim, with the alleged harasser, maybe with other witnesses that are involved, depending on the circumstances, and just do a check-in. How are you today? I mean, it doesn't have to be anything formal. It doesn't need to be a big deal. It doesn't have to take an hour. It's just a quick check-in. And I always say to my clients, I would do that on a very consistent basis for a couple of weeks, and then I may titrate that down to a couple times a month just to make sure that the problem is resolved. I mean, you know, I think what's important is that people feel safe coming to HR or going to a supervisor and knowing that something is going to be done. That's really what the critical issue is.
No, that is the important part, is that they understand that there is a go-forward process. We're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford, managing partner from Jackson Lewis, and we're talking about #MeToo, sexual harassment goes viral. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLLB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, we're talking with Deborah Weiss-Ford, Managing Principal for Jackson Lewis, a great sponsor of the HR Power Hour. I'm your host, David Chulo, and we're talking about hashtag MeToo, sexual harassment goes viral. Deb, we've talked a lot about the actual responsibilities of supervisors. We've talked a little about the changes in harassment today. And I'd like to take this segment and talk a little bit about probably one of the most important things that HR does, and that's conducting the internal investigations. Because I know, and I know you know this, this sometimes is the most challenging part in regards to conducting a thorough investigation or conducting an investigation that can hold up in when tested. What are you seeing from an investigation standpoint that may be different today than what a employer has done in the past?
Yeah, I think what's different about it is that the courts and the federal and state agencies are very focused on investigations and whether they are A, being done, and B, if they are being done, are they effective and done by the proper person. So when we are involved in litigation, it is just absolutely common now to have the employee say that an investigation was not done properly. It wasn't done by the right person. The person wasn't trained, and that the investigator didn't talk to the witnesses I wanted the investigator to talk to and reach an improper conclusion. So with the heightened awareness in sexual harassment complaints and other types of protected classification complaints, the emphasis on the proper investigation has been very scrutinized in this day and age, and I think that's just going to continue for a while.
So let's talk about that for just a second. So someone's trained to investigate, somebody's approved to investigate. How do you define that? Because a lot of HR professionals will say, well, I've been doing investigations for years, and I'm not necessarily, quote-unquote, trained to do investigations, but I can certainly talk to two people and get information. Talk to us about what is a standard today, maybe versus what it was in the past.
Yeah, it's a good question, and you know, it's actually it sounds like an easy question, but it's a tough question to answer. So there are lots of courses. I mean, people can be certified now in doing investigations, and there are several organizations that do that. And there are also courses that one can take and seminars that one can take to become proficient in doing investigations. But there are a fair amount of people who have been doing investigations for years and have on-the-job training, which in my opinion is fine. You know, as long as someone is comfortable doing an investigation, understands what needs to be done, stays current on the requirements of the investigation and the best practices, then I think that's fine. But often what I see is, A, no investigation is being done at all. The employer may hear some buzzwords like harassment or bullying or hostile environment or I'm uncomfortable or this is unwelcome, and the employer doesn't do anything about that. And those are usually triggers for some type of investigation. So that's a problem. And then the person who does the investigation needs really to be vetted. I mean, for example, I had a case at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission where an HR professional did an investigation, but the person being investigated was the CEO to whom the HR director reported. So that was the direct report. And that's not a good idea. You really can't have an investigation being done by someone who is reporting to the boss because, you know, it has all kinds of issues with it. So in those circumstances, you may need to go outside the organization to do an investigation.
So you have 10 rules for conducting an effective internal investigation. And while, of course, we don't have time to necessarily go through all of those today, I wanted to mention that because I know you do this as a program and you do this for organizations. Tell me a little bit about that training, about that development, and how employers could look at that and say, hey, that's maybe something I should look at for my team.
Yeah, I get asked a lot and have been in the past 3 years or so, I would say, with certainly an increase in the last year, to come into organizations and talk about effective investigations. And, you know, we talk about the issues of when do you need to investigate, what triggers the obligation under federal or state law. How are you going to choose the investigator? And that goes back to what we just talked about with, you know, who is the person best situated to do the investigation. Can I do it internally? Do I have trained people? Or do I need to go outside the organization to hire a consultant? And so we talk about that. We talk about the mechanics of it. Who do I interview? What type of questions should I ask? Should I be keeping notes? You know, do I record? Are these attorney-client privilege issues? Confidentiality issues. Do I tell other employees or witnesses what I am investigating? So the confidentiality issues becomes important and actually kind of complicated. From there, we talk about the report. Because there has to be some type of a document, whether it's a formal report or something, some type of a memorandum, but we need some kind of a documentation for historical references so that we know that an investigation was done, what was the issue, what's the conclusion that was reached, what are the remedies that are being taken. All of those type of things are really not intuitive. They're really a learned, trained technique that needs to be explained and explored with attendees.
You know, one of the questions that always comes up about investigation, and we talked a little bit about at the beginning, was who to do the investigation. But I want to take that just a step further for a second and say, okay, you know, sometimes you hear from attorneys, it should be an attorney do the investigation. Sometimes you hear it should not be an attorney that does the investigation. What's your position on that?
So I'll give you a lawyer answer. It depends.
You did not disappoint. I knew you would have that answer.
Yeah, sooner or later I have to say that to you.
That's right. I'd be disappointed if you didn't.
And it really does depend. You know, for example, I had one of my clients was complaining of a potential theft in the workplace, and we retained a former police chief, a retired former police chief, to do the investigation. And so I think it really depends on the circumstances. For that situation, that was the right person to do it. Sometimes I think that it's right for attorneys to do it, depending on the circumstances, depending on how complicated it is, depending on whether, you know, you have a need for attorney-client confidentiality. And oftentimes, it can be a HR professional. As long as that person is trained and as long as that person is independent and has the leeway to use discretion, that's perfectly acceptable as well.
You mentioned, as we talked about this, is that social media has really changed the landscape in regards to the ability of people to communicate what is going on in their workplace, and really has heightened this whole issue in regards to hashtag MeToo. Where do you see that going?
I think that's just going to become more and more of an issue. Not that that's necessarily negative. Some of it is positive. If it can change a culture that needs fixing, then it is a very, very effective way of doing that. But I don't see us going back to anywhere near where we were, even 5 years ago. The explosion of social media, the ease of social media, the opportunity to, in a second, really, and really in a nanosecond, you know, to respond to an allegation or to just give a thumbs up is it's easy to do and it's very, very powerful. I mean, you look at change.org. That's really an incredible movement that has literally changed lots and lots of things just by going online and having people chime in. And hashtag MeToo is really a prime example of that. I mean, as I said, it started by an actor. It was just October of 2017, Dave, so it's not that long ago.
No, it's crazy, isn't it?
It's not. It's really, it just encouraged survivors of sexual harassment and assault to post publicly and adopt hashtag MeToo status. So that's October. That's, what, 3 months ago. And it just went global and viral, and I do not see it stopping.
No, I don't see it even. I think, as you said, it has pluses and minuses in terms of what the impact is and challenges for employers if they don't do the right thing, because it really can affect an employer's brand. And I think that is an understated piece of this puzzle in terms of what can happen.
I agree. I mean, look, the reputation is everything for most employers. And without that, you really are lost. So these things become public and viral so quickly. And for employers not to stay ahead of this just seems to be a big mistake in today's world.
We're talking with Deborah Weiss Ford, Managing Principal for Jackson Lewis Law Firm, employment attorney. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Kelly Flagg, General Manager of the Body Architect Fitness Center in Portland, Maine. I want to personally invite you to come meet us. If you've been considering joining a gym but haven't yet because you're a little nervous or just plain old don't like the gym, come see us. We have created a 30-day personal training experience just for you. Meet our trainers, try a few workouts, and use our facility for 30 days for just $79. Call 774-2196 or visit thebodyarchitect.com today.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking the one, the only, Deborah Weiss Ford, Managing Principal for Jackson Lewis Law Firm, and we're talking about hashtag MeToo, sexual harassment goes viral. Deb, this has been a great show and so timely and so relevant to what's going on in the world today. What are three things that, you know, if somebody has not necessarily been able to listen to the whole show that's coming in about halfway through, they go, hey, what are the three things I can do right now as an employer, as an owner, as an HR professional that can make a difference with this topic in my workplace?
Sure. So, you know, the issue is really, in my mind, what employers should do now. So three tips. One, the policies. I think employers, almost everyone has a policy in this day and age. But if you don't, obviously, you need to have an effective anti-harassment, respect in the workplace policy. And if you do have one, you really should look at it again. It may be that it was done a few years ago, and it may be stale. And I think it's important to maintain robust policies which are going to prohibit all forms of harassment based on a protected class and are also going to explain the reporting procedure, which needs to be clear and to have a strong policy prohibiting retaliation. Two, training. We've been talking about that all morning. Training all employees, supervisors and non-supervisors on discrimination, on harassment, on reporting, on retaliation. And I would include bullying on that. And to me, the focus should be on what employees should do and not only on what they should not do. So just go beyond the legal definitions. And then three, as we talked about, investigations. They are complicated. It really requires a great deal of training, and it requires not only the training, but they need to be people who listen well, who are well-versed in asking open-ended questions and getting people to talk and being able to have an open dialogue with the accused and with the victim and with the potential witnesses. And those are really the three things, Dave, that I think employers should be focusing on to deal with the hashtag MeToo environment.
Well, I'll tell you, it has changed the world. It has changed the way people think about this. And I think respectful workplaces now have a different connotations and meaning than they used to. And I'm not saying that's bad. I actually think it's a good thing. It's just an amazing change from even 6 months ago or 3 months ago, if you want to get technical. It's just amazing. Deb, as we wrap up the show today and as we look at 2018, any key areas that you see that employers need to be focused on in terms of making sure that they're prepared for the rest of 2018?
I think, you know, we all need to just be aware that we're likely going to see lots of changes in 2018. You know, the sexual harassment explosion is going to continue to be a hot topic. I expect that we will see more litigation, and I expect that we will see the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission continue to be aggressive in going forward on these matters. That's going to be an issue. We're noticing a lot of changes in non-compete areas. There have been various state laws that have been passed or are pending that deal with non-compete issues, so I think we'll see some more litigation in that regard. Also, as you know, the National Labor Relations Board has been changing under the Trump administration and has been issuing opinions lately which are more pro-employer, and I think that's going to continue and probably become more aggressive in 2018. So this will mean for employers to keep a careful eye on that. It's going to matter to how they draft policies and maybe want to change some policies. So there are going to be plenty of things for you to talk about on your Saturday morning program.
There is no question.
You're not going to run out of topics in 2018.
No, there is no question. It's interesting. We were just talking about the fact that from a topic perspective, we literally have 4 months of topics lined up. It's just incredible, really, the amount of change that has happened. And it's exciting if you want to say a policy geek type HR perspective, right? It's just exciting for us, you know?
It's not boring.
No question about it. Well, again, Deborah Weiss Ford, Managing Partner, Employment Attorney with Jackson Lewis, thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you for being a sponsor of the HR Power Hour. We love having you on and look forward to having you back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, as always, and I appreciate the opportunity.
You can certainly find out all about Deb at hrpowerhour.com. We will have her information. We, of course, have her sponsorship information there in regards to the company. Please call her. She does amazing training and development and is just an awesome attorney. So we appreciate it very much. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
Hold me now. It's not an 80s hit from the Thompson Twins. It's litigation time. Hi, this is Ben Ford from Veral Dana's Labor and Employment Group. A litigation hold letter is a document sent out from lawyers on either side of the case. It essentially says, you are or are about to be sued, and so you better not destroy any evidence. These letters are serious business and designed to put you on notice that if anything goes missing, the opposing party can ask the court for a sanction, what fancy lawyers call a penalty. Let's say a company is being sued by a former employee. The employee's lawyer sends a litigation hold letter, and say 15 days later, the company's email system runs its usual data purge and deletes emails older than, say, 3 years. In that deletion was the smoking gun email that would have either proven or disproven the employee's case. Because the company did not preserve the email, the employee's lawyer can ask the court for what we call a spoliation award, which may include allowing the jury to infer that the email would have been bad for the company. If you have a litigation hold letter, take it seriously. Stop any auto-deletion programs, instruct all the relevant witnesses not to destroy anything, and contact Veral Dana.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, David Blades, founder and CEO of RPI, discusses his new book, I Just Lost My Job, Now What? A Guide to Financial Survival After Losing Your Job. Oh my God, I just lost my job, my family counts on my income. What do I do and what do I not do? Well, David Blades talks to your host, David Chulo, about the top 10 financial mistakes to avoid during job transition. How to deal with cash flow, 401ks, do's and don'ts. They're all there in his new book. Also, he has a special free offer. If anyone listening wants a complimentary copy of the new book, he'll be happy to send them one. Just email him. You can get that information. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.